From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
According to the CDC, osteoarthritis affects 30 million Americans. Osteoarthritis is a degenerative disease that worsens over time. Joint pain and stiffness can become severe enough to make daily tasks difficult.
On today's program, we'll talk about osteoarthritis with a Mayo Clinic expert.
That's where the body's immune cells, which are there to protect our body from foreign organisms like bacteria, get confused and start to attack the joint, specifically the lining of the joints called the synovium.
Also on the program, the importance of blood donation.
And we've got tips to get you moving in the new year. All that, along with this week's health and medical news. Osteoarthritis, also known as wear and tear arthritis or degenerative arthritis, is the most common form of arthritis, affecting millions of people worldwide. It occurs when the protective cartilage on the ends of your bones wears down over time. Although arthritis or osteoarthritis can involve any joint in your body, it most commonly affects joints in your hands, your knees, your hips, and your spine.
Although the underlying process cannot be reversed, osteoarthritis symptoms can usually be effectively managed. And here to discuss osteoarthritis and how it can be treated is Mayo Clinic rheumatologist Dr. Shreyasi Amin. Dr. Amin, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yep, Dr. Amin, good to have you. So explain the term arthritis to us. I assume arth or arthron, as I think originally a Greek word, has to do with a joint. And the itis suggests that it's inflammation of the joint. It's more than that, though, isn't it?
It is. It's more than just inflammation. There is damage that occurs at multiple aspects of the joint. So you've alluded to already that the cartilage is affected, but it is the entire joint, including the bone and the surrounding tissues, including the capsule and the synovial tissue, which is another lining of the joint itself, and then the surrounding muscles and tissues, including the tendons.
Is this like macular degeneration, for instance? If you live long enough, everyone ends up with arthritis?
Well, genetics does play a role, and damage over time to the joints, depending on how you use and abuse your joints, certainly can affect you. So the older you are, you are more likely to accumulate those forms of damage, for example. But there are people who do very well and have very little in the way of symptoms, although radiographically they may have evidence of arthritis.
So everybody's cartilage wears out over time.
You know, I can't say we've studied everybody, but certainly over time,
most
that is
a
likely effect of just wear and tear over the time and loading over the joints, especially the knee, for example.
But isn't it interesting, though, that people who have been sedentary their whole life are just as likely, are they not, to get arthritis?
Well, you know, there are forms of arthritis even in the hands. We're not necessarily walking on our hands. We are using them. But there's been an interesting relation between obesity and hand arthritis. So there is some suggestion that certain molecules that promote inflammation, such as adipokines, might be playing a role. And so that needs to be explored further.
Adipokines?
Adipokines.
Yeah.
So these inflammatory mediators that are thought to be related to more adiposity or fat.
And maybe women have more of those than men, because this is a condition that's more common in women than men, isn't it?
It depends on the age. So in younger years, men may be more likely, possibly related to sports-related injuries, harder to say. But after the menopause, women do have frequent osteoarthritis.
And family history also plays a role, too. If your mom and dad had arthritis, you're more likely to have it.
Genetics does play a role, exactly, especially in the joints of the hands. We find the smaller joints near the nails, for example.
How does osteoarthritis affect a person just on an everyday basis?
Well, there's two things we think about, is pain and then function, and it depends on the joints affected. So, for example, if you have osteoarthritis in your hands, especially at the base of the thumb, that affects grip and day-to-day activities. When you think about it, we use our hands quite a bit, and we use our thumbs particularly. So that can have an effect on just smaller day-to-day activities, such as squeezing the toothpaste out of your toothbrush, writing, for example. Even smaller items like making a meal, for example, or even using tools. And then when it comes to even recreation, people have trouble holding a golf club or a racket, for example.
So pain a problem, stiffness also, loss of motion.
Yes, pain is one thing, but function is the other, you're right. So stiffness that can affect them in the mornings, or if they've been sitting for a while, we call it gelling. It's hard for them to stand up because they're just a little stiff like a tin man, for example.
The painful sting of recognition. Does that get any better, or does it patients who notice that stiffness in the morning or upon getting up and moving around?
Well, in the mornings, for example, it does improve with activity or with movement. So most people will feel that they loosen up after a few minutes, sometimes a little longer. As we get older, I think it depends on how we try to help combat the arthritis and what we can do to preserve the joints. So we can preserve both function, but also limit the pain that's associated with it.
Does weather affect arthritis? I mean, you have had patients, too, just like I have, who say, I can tell when the weather's going to change. Or weather has an effect on my arthritis and how much discomfort I have.
I think I certainly have that comment from many of my patients, and I believe it has probably more to do with barometric pressure change. So the change in the barometric pressure more than just what it is at one static time.
Diagnosis. How do you make the definitive diagnosis? And then to also tell us the difference between this most common form of arthritis. I know there's 100 different kinds of arthritis, but this one and rheumatoid arthritis.
Well, the diagnosis is based in part by symptoms, your physical examination of the joint that is affected. Sometimes we are able to add radiographs or x-rays to that, and sometimes blood tests help us exclude other things. So blood tests themselves aren't part of the diagnosis. So it's symptoms, the examination of the joints, and the x-rays sometimes will help.
Yeah, there are not any blood abnormalities in patients who have osteoarthritis, but there are in rheumatoid arthritis.
Correct.
So tell us the difference between the two there.
So in terms of the difference between the two, as we talked about before, osteoarthritis is more the wear and tear arthritis that we talk about as we get older, possibly related to other aspects of damage of the joint, whereas rheumatoid arthritis is what we call an autoimmune disease. That's where the body's immune cells, which are there to protect our body from foreign organisms like bacteria, get confused and start to attack the joint, specifically the lining of the joints called the synovium. And then there's production of inflammatory cells that work towards causing not only inflammation that contributes to pain of the joint, but also damage over time to the joint itself. And it's fairly accelerated.
Yeah, the body attacking itself. It's one of those diseases.
Correct.
Autoimmune.
Correct.
So it's diagnosed, the osteoarthritis is diagnosed through symptoms.
Correct.
Possibly a scan of some
X-ray.
X-rays are
mostly
X-ray
just is all you need.
Okay. So,
but it's also symptoms and X-rays. Correct.
What do you do at the next point then? Once it's been diagnosed.
Once it's been diagnosed, then we try to help them with the symptoms that are most bothersome. So pain is usually one of the things that bring people to the attention of the doctor, but also function. Try to help preserve the function that they have without causing more accelerated problems over time. And sorry, I should go back to say when we talk about symptoms, it's also trying to discern the types of arthritis. So we ask questions to help us define what might be osteoarthritis compared to other forms of autoimmune arthritis, what we call inflammatory autoimmune arthritis.
I know what else I was going to ask. So it's age-related is a piece in there. Genetics is a piece in there. Who else is at risk for arthritis?
Some of our patients with autoimmune diseases, even though we get them under control, because of inflammation that contributes to damage of the joint. And once the damage is there, it can increase over time. Patients who have had trauma. So if they've had a fracture,
injury,
through a joint or a trauma to the joint, will increase the risk for damage, accelerated damage.
Is smoking something that makes a difference?
That's a good question. So if you look at studies, smokers in general have a lower risk, and the thought is because they have a lower body weight compared to people, the general population. Mm-hmm. We've done some studies to show that smokers have more pain in their knee, and that has also been shown in people who have back pain as well.
Well, there's never a good reason to smoke, I guess. All right, we're talking about osteoarthritis, degenerative type arthritis, with a Mayo Clinic expert, Dr. Shreya C. Amin. Time for a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about treatment options for degenerative arthritis, plus prevention of osteoarthritis. And we've got a myth or matter of fact.
Yes, if I develop osteoarthritis, I won't be able to exercise. Is that a myth or a fact? We'll find out.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. We are talking about osteoarthritis, degenerative type arthritis, with Mayo Clinic rheumatologist Dr. Shreya C. Amin. Myth or matter of fact?
If I develop osteoarthritis, I'm going to have an excellent excuse. I won't be able to exercise. Is that a myth or a fact?
That's a myth.
That's good.
All right. Newly diagnosed patient with osteoarthritis, degenerative arthritis. What do you tell them?
Well, it depends on the joints that are affected, but I tell them we need to help them with their pain management if that's one of their main concerns. But also we talk about lifestyle changes and potential ways of exercising that will help them either gain a better body weight if that's an issue, but also exercises that will strengthen their joints and will help preserve their joints over time, especially at the knee.
So really, when you're talking about exercise, you're not talking about so much about strengthening the joint, but you're talking about strengthening the muscles to take some stress off the joint.
Correct. That's correct.
And activity modification is a big part of it, huh?
It is. It is. I think it depends on what they're doing or not doing. But we also want to make sure that they're doing their exercises with good footwear, good conditioning, warming up beforehand, stretching after, so they don't injure themselves as well.
Swimming's a great exercise, isn't it, for people with osteoarthritis?
Water-based exercises for people, especially if they have arthritis of their knees or their hips, because that help it hurts them to walk or to load bear. So water-based exercises in a warm pool, doesn't have to be swimming. They can do aerobic exercises or walking in water. That helps get the aerobic exercise they need to help them with weight loss, but without having to put a lot of pressure on their joints. Walking exercises, though, on a treadmill, with good footwear, is important.
What about medications or even supplements?
Well, it depends on your pain symptoms and how long they're occurring. If it's short-lived, I don't recommend long-term medications. If, on the other hand, you have pain with sustained activity or even at rest, then we talk about pain management strategies that are safe. Although acetaminophen may be the weakest medication, it is among the more safe medications as long as it's taken in the right amounts and not overdosing themselves. Especially, we have to think about over-the-counter medications or supplements that have acetaminophen in it so they don't exceed the maximum required amount.
So you like acetaminophen better than ibuprofen?
Correct, from a safety profile, if people have
less
to use
side
it.
Effects.
Correct, correct.
And mainly the side effects with the ibuprofen or the NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, are stomach-related, bleeding-related?
It could be from stomach ulcers or just stomach upset, and stomach ulcers are the biggest concerns, but also it can affect the kidneys. It can also adversely affect blood pressure or it can aggravate hypertension. And we have to think about their blood counts, and we have to watch that they don't have a drop in hemoglobin that because of occult blood loss that they are even not aware of.
Yeah, but isn't it true, though, itis, inflammation, is part of this process? Acetaminophen doesn't have any effect on the inflammation, whereas ibuprofen does. So theoretically, wouldn't the ibuprofen-type drugs be more effective?
They are more effective than acetaminophen in some respects because of that effect on inflammation. So I try to use it more judiciously. So if people do have to use something chronically, I prefer to try acetaminophen first and then use the anti-inflammatory pills over short courses if possible.
They're the non-prescription ibuprofen-type drugs, and then there are prescription drugs. Are the prescription drugs more effective than over-the-counter?
Not necessarily. So the over-the-counter doses may be less effective, but if we use them at the therapeutic levels, we can have just as good effect as the prescription forms. We just have to remember that everyone responds to anti-inflammatory just a little differently. So if they fail one, we can try others and see if it's effective for them.
Because of the prescription anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, there are multiple different ones. How do you choose, and is one better than the other?
I wouldn't say one is better than another, but there are some that are more potent, so they could be more effective than more mild forms. But I think we want to choose one that is safe, tolerable, and effective. And if one is not effective, I move to others.
Are supplements helpful?
It's a very good question. There's been a lot of interest in looking at over-the-counter supplements, but at present time, we don't have a lot of good options. I think one of the more common ones that people have heard about is glucosamine and chondroitin. Current guidelines right now from many societies have not recommended their use at this time.
Is that right?
Correct.
Because I thought it was sort of 50-50. You know, there were half the people that helped and half it didn't help. But now you're not recommending it.
None of the sites.
Glucosamine, chondroitin,
sulfate. Correct.
All right. And then there are those other supplements on the market. And I'm thinking of OsteoBiflex and Arthromax, for example, most of which contain chondroitin and glucosamine. So you're not a big fan.
You know, I do talk to my patients about it. They're always interested in finding something that will help them. I give them the option, if they want to try it, that they want to take it for 3 months. If they find it beneficial, then I'm okay with that. But if it doesn't give them any benefit, I don't recommend they continue it, just like any medication or elsewhere.
All right. So, and if those things don't work, then there really are surgical options. I suppose you can get your knee replaced, but is there anything in between those?
Right. So we have other options. So in terms of chronic pain management, if we're just talking about pain, we've talked about Tylenol, NSAIDs, but there are other medications such as duloxetine that is in the antidepressant family, but that has been approved for pain management in osteoarthritis. We also have options of topical therapies. So there are topical NSAIDs, for example, like Voltaren gel. There are capsaicin products. And those have been somewhat helpful for pain management. Then we have intra-articular products, so one of them being steroids that we can inject into a joint. They may have more short-term effects, so I try to use that again in the setting of someone who's had more acute worsening in their pain, and we're trying to get that under control.
All right, so yeah, quickly, I want to ask you about several different kinds of injections. Does cortisone increase the breakdown of cartilage?
It can.
Okay, so you use it maybe 3 to 4 times a year. You don't want to get a cortisone injection every week.
Correct. We try to reserve not to use it more frequently than 3-month intervals if we have to. But if it doesn't give long-term benefit, I don't like to continue using it.
All right, hyaluronic acid, Synvisc and Hyalgan.
So it is approved for the use of osteoarthritis. Whether it's the efficacy, I think, is just a bit weaker. Okay. The data is weaker, but I do offer that to my patients if we have nothing else that is helping them and they are not interested in surgical options either.
All right, PRP, platelet-rich plasma injections.
There's a lot of interest in PRP. The quality of the studies right now are a little poor right now, but I think there's more information that needs to be accumulated before we recommend that. So I think it's probably more useful in a study situation.
All right, the evidence is a little shaky.
Correct.
And similarly for stem cell injections?
Correct.
All right, we've been talking about osteoarthritis, everything you wanted to know about prevention, treatment, diagnosis, with an expert rheumatologist, Dr. Shreyasi Amin. Dr. Amin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, January is American Blood Donor Month. We'll discuss the continuous need for blood donors with a Mayo Clinic expert. And later on in the program, tips to help you get exercising in the new year.
Don't miss a minute of Mayo Clinic Radio. Subscribe today to the Mayo Clinic Radio podcast, available on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and other podcast apps.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. You have a big event coming up and need to fit into that great dress, so you crash diet only to gain it all back again. If this sounds familiar, you could be yo-yo dieting. But research shows yo-yo dieting, also called weight cycling, is hard on your heart. Dr. Amy Pollack, a Mayo Clinic cardiologist, says one way to avoid the problems associated with yo-yo dieting is to eat according to the Mediterranean diet, which incorporates fruits, veggies, whole grains, fish, olive oil, nuts, low-fat dairy, and herbs and spices instead of salt to flavor foods. Dr. Pollack says research shows postmenopausal women who yo-yo diet, where they gain weight and lose weight and gain weight and lose weight, seem to be at higher risk of cardiovascular death, so that means dying from a heart attack or stroke. Dr. Pollack says it's not totally clear yet why yo-yo dieting is unhealthy, so more research is needed, but she says they do know. One diet that's proven to lower your risk over time is the Mediterranean diet. And in other news, can you train your brain to be happier? Well, Mayo experts say yes. You see, your brain has two modes. One is called the default mode, and the other is called the focus mode. You spend about 50 to 80% of your time in default mode, where your thoughts are wandering, you're obsessing about things, or assessing threats and your personal faults. The remaining time, you're thinking about happy things or new and interesting situations. The 5-3-2 plan can help keep your mind focused on the positive. Five is for five people who can help you start each day with gratitude. So when you first wake up, think of five people you love and for whom you're grateful. Silently thank them. Three is for 3 minutes to find newness in those you already love. So at the end of the workday or school day, take 3 minutes to spend some time with someone you love. Really listen to them. Tell them how much you appreciate them and honestly praise them. Two is for 2 seconds to see others differently. Choose to be positive before you judge or silently wish someone well as you encounter them. Always to help train your brain for happiness. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Millions of people need blood transfusions every year. Now, some may need blood during surgery, others depend on it after an accident, or because they have a disease that destroys the blood or one of its components. Blood donation makes all of this possible. According to the American Red Cross, winter is one of the most difficult times of the year to collect enough blood products to meet patient needs. Busy holiday schedules, bad weather, and seasonal illnesses like the flu can affect donations considerably.
Sure. And that's why National Blood Donor Month, which has taken place each January since 1970, is such an important observance. And here to discuss the importance of blood donation is medical director of the Blood Donor Center at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Justin Kreuter. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Kreuter. It's good to see you again.
Thanks. Pleasure to be back.
Thanks, Dr. Kreuter. So difficult time of the year for you.
Absolutely. For all those reasons that you just mentioned, you know, people get sick with colds and flus that are going around. People are wanting to visit their relatives. And, you know, when big snowstorms hit, people can't make it to the blood donor centers to actually give that blood.
What does the population of blood donors look like?
Yeah, it's going to vary from program and what the location is. Although that said, I think nationally, there certainly is a huge importance in younger donors. So donors in their 20s, 30s, and 40s to give donation a chance. There's a lot of people that haven't even tried to donate blood. A lot of people also just assume that maybe they're ineligible. And really, eligibility is really going to be a local thing. You want to call your local blood donor center and find out if you're eligible and if you can come in and donate.
What are some of the things that would make you ineligible?
Yeah, broadly speaking, you know, you really want to make sure that it's safe for somebody to donate blood. So we're really interested about medical conditions, especially somebody's heart. You know, the cardiovascular system is connected and important. We're also going to be really focused on, is the blood safe for another person to receive? So if somebody is taking an antibiotic because they got a small infection that doesn't really bother them, we still don't want to collect that blood because there might be some bacteria then that would get in and be transferred to the patient. And as you know, some of our patients don't really have that strong of an immune system right now, and we could really be putting them at risk. So when we're looking at who's eligible to donate blood, it's are you safe to donate blood? And then is your blood safe to give to a patient?
Any other contraindications other than you mentioned infection, someone who's had a recent infection?
Yeah.
Who else might not be eligible?
Yeah, there's a whole list of you know, what somebody is eligible or not eligible for. You know, if you've had a recent heart attack, obviously, then we're concerned about your own personal health. Certain medications that donor may be taking, like finasteride, because that donor should wait for about a month after taking their last dose, because that could cause defects for a fetus if it was transfused to a mother who's pregnant.
Probably the better way to do it is if you're unsure, try to donate blood. And there's all sorts of screening that happens before that ever occurs.
Absolutely. So, you know, reach out, either call your blood donor program and ask them some of the questions where you think might put you maybe not eligible and just see, or just show up. I mean, this is what we really live to do, is find out if somebody is eligible or not.
How about a history of cancer? Can you still donate?
That's going to be variable based on what center you go to. So that's a great example of it, because that speaks to your own personal fitness for donating. So here at Mayo Clinic, for example, we let people donate if they've had a history of cancer after about 1 year for most cancers. Bloodborne cancers like leukemia and lymphoma, right now we're still deferring, but that's going to be variable.
I'm going to live long enough so that someday you'll be able to say, yeah, we'll take your blood too, Tracy.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for.
You've been rejected?
Well, because I have lymphoma.
Mm-hmm. Really?
It's been 30 years, but I'm going to stick it out, I swear.
And you're the person that we're targeting for.
That's good. What happens to the blood after it's donated?
When you donate blood, we're going to take that donation, we're going to process it into a blood unit that gets transfused to a patient. So we do a little bit of manipulation in the back room. We also send off some testing for some of the common concerning infectious diseases like HIV, hepatitis B and C. And we wait for the infectious testing to come back. Once that's back and negative, then we can put a label on it and ship it out to the hospitals to use.
Does the amount of blood that you need vary with the seasons?
It does. It varies by season. So we see peaks and valleys throughout the year. Some of it's predictable, but then on a day-to-day basis, there's also quite a lot of variability. And that kind of highlights that, you know, sometimes tragedies can strike in our communities, either weather-related or otherwise. And it's really the people that came in and donated recently in the past few days that are going to have that blood on the shelf for the patients that are in need.
What's the shelf life of that blood?
In general, red cells are good on the shelf for 42 days. Platelets are good on the shelf for 5 days. Plasma, we can freeze for a full year. And so I guess how we monitor the inventory of blood, it's a little bit like having milk. I know Dr. Shives likes Raisin Bran for breakfast in the morning.
How'd you know that?
So I'm guessing you probably like to have milk with your Raisin Bran. So you like milk to be in your fridge, but you also don't like your milk curdled, I bet.
So just keep the look, keep a lookout on that date, that expiration date.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
you can't freeze milk on. Yeah. You can't freeze blood, though, huh? Just the plasma?
We can freeze red cells, but that is a very intensive process, and we also lose some of that blood product in the process. So we do that for rare blood units.
And how often can you donate? How long does it take you to recover between donations?
That's an excellent question. That really gets at something that the blood donor community, we're wrestling with right now. So in the United States, you can donate every 8 weeks, but there's a real concern about preserving and protecting the iron stores of our blood donors. And so that's undergoing a lot of debate. We might see that changing in the future.
Longer or shorter?
For longer.
Longer.
Yeah.
I just have to say, and I know I've probably shared this in the past, but just as we referenced the lymphoma, when I was going through my treatment, I had to have a transfusion. Mm-hmm. And it is amazing how much better I felt just a few moments after that transfusion happened. So if anyone is listening and on the fence about whether they should donate or not, yes for accidents, yes for surgeries, but also, patients that need transfusions, it makes a huge difference, life-saving and just quality of life.
You know, recently I was at my daughter's school talking mm-hmm. about blood donation, and it was wonderful to see the masterful teacher talk to the kids about, you know, oh, do you think that it hurts when you get a needle? And you know, all the kids, oh, yeah. And how long does that needle prick hurt for? And the kids are, oh, it's a short period of time. And she said, you know, do you think people that are sick in the hospital, or do you think they hurt? And the kids said, yeah. And they said, how long do you think they hurt for? A long time.
Yeah.
And it just kind of goes to show, I think there's a lot of people that have a fear of needles, or they don't like the pain. But that little bit of pain that we take does result in a very meaningful and significant immediate difference for a patient in need.
Absolutely.
How old do you have to be to donate blood? You didn't get all those fifth graders into the blood donation center, did you?
No, but I'm hopefully making future blood donors
good
out
for
of
you.
Them. So you have to be at least 17, and in some states you can be 16. But again, that's another area where we're really particularly concerned about wanting to preserve the iron status of, in particular, our younger donors. So that's something that's what's on the books right now, but that might change in the future.
Well, it's Blood Donor Month. Thanks for helping us get the word out. And whoever donated that unit of blood for Tracy, you made her feel better.
That's right.
All right. Blood Donation Month with the medical director of the Blood Donor Center at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, Dr. Justin Kreider. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Kreider.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, it's New Year's resolution time. If exercise is on your list, we've got tips to get you moving.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Well, the holidays are over. Are you happy about that?
Thank goodness.
It's back to the routine, normal activities. And for a lot of us, we've set some goals for the new year, and getting fit and losing weight are often high on the list of people's New Year's resolutions. Now, whether your goal is weight loss or just feeling better and being healthier, adding activity to your day will help get you there.
Here's the million-dollar question. Yeah. How do you get started?
Yeah, well, we're going to find out.
Yeah. How do you stay motivated and avoid the common pitfalls? Here to offer tips to help you get moving is Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program Wellness Specialist Tom Rick. Welcome to the program, Tom. It's nice to meet you.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the Healthy Dan Living Center is a pretty incredible place. Dan Abraham was a patient here and donated a significant portion of the money required to build this facility, mm-hmm. right?
If you're someone who's newly retired from being a surgeon, you can hang out there more often than you do. Getting people started, though, I think is the first time is always easy because you're all excited. You're going to start this new thing. But then maybe the second time is when the wheels fall off.
Correct. And I think what we do is we set ourselves up for a little bit of failure. So the new year rolls around, and we start with these big, huge, audacious goals that I want to lose 500 pounds in the next 2 weeks. And of course, that's not realistic. I tell people we start very small and we get that goal, or we try an experiment and we learn from that. And then we rack it up a little bit for the next portion. So I even had one client that said, I have a 1 pound weight loss goal. And I said, 1 pound? I mean, you know who you're hiring here, right? And she said, well, I know because I've failed so many other times that if I start really small with this 1 pound goal, which seems ridiculous, but she knows it's something that's achievable. And then, you know, maybe it's the next couple of weeks I can say, okay, now I'm going to go for 2 pounds and work my way up from there. So making sure that we don't have too big of a goal to start off with seems to help.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. Give an example of a small goal. And you could always just say, I've got a 1 pound goal, and you just continue to have a 1 pound goal.
You got it. Yep. And I just keep adding, you know, mm-hmm. next week it's another right? 1 pound goal.
Any other suggestions for small goals that people could consider?
Sure. So I always ask people, say, well, you know, how much time do you have to devote for exercise? And they say, well, I've got 90 minutes every single day. And I go, really? Do you live in that wonderful world that we all dream about? Of course not. And I say, well, what if we start with a third of that? Let's start with 30 minutes. And then I counsel them and say, well, if you can't make 30 minutes today, 29 minutes is still pretty good. And if 29 doesn't work, 28 is still pretty good there. And so maybe it only becomes, I can only make it for 5 minutes today. And just knowing that little bit of 5 minute movement is going to be beneficial much more than if you just said, skip it, I'm going to go sit on the couch instead.
When somebody first comes to you, someone new, how do you approach the first meeting?
Sure. So we do quite a big intake when people come through our program at the Healthy Living Center. We also work with wellness coaches. So that's a really nice person to have kind of in your corner. And their kind of approach to health and fitness is much different than most people's because they're not telling you what to do. So I come from I'm going to tell you what to do after we find out a little bit about you. And they say, well, what is your goal and how can I help you achieve that? And so we do a lot of different assessments to give people a good baseline. And I always counsel people, say, you know, take a look at the scale, take a look at some measurements and see where we're at, but then don't necessarily focus on those pieces. Focus on the outcomes, focus on that journey to getting to whatever that goal may be. And then you'll find out it takes a lot of the pressure off from having to meet that, you know, scale goal on a daily basis.
What are some of the common pitfalls that people will encounter?
Oh, there's so many. You know, the big goal is number one, the kind of overextending themselves, and then not celebrating those small little successes, I think, too. So you know, my goal or my experiment today was to make it to the gym five times this week. Ooh. But I only made it four. Well,
that's impressive.
Yeah. But I didn't get, you know, I didn't make my goal. So now all of a sudden I've got this kind of negative self-talk and I'm missing out on the point in celebrating the, I made it to the gym four times this week, or I made it outside four times this week.
Is it a good idea if you're going to start an exercise or a wellness program that you see your physician first? Is there any reason I shouldn't?
I would love for you to go see your physician, absolutely, because there's so much things that we don't know about that's going on inside of our body. You know, I can't tell what my glucose is right now or if I have high blood pressure. So getting that little kind of check mark and that little stamp of approval from your physician, I think is very beneficial. And again, you can find some of those kind of baseline numbers so that when you come back in 6 months or another year, you can, again, celebrate those small successes saying, I went to the gym, I got my exercise session, or I got my movement session in, and look at what it's done to my blood pressure or my glucose.
According to my show prep here, 80% of people will have quit their exercise goals by February. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And we're trying to change that, right? We're trying to get that number down and down and more. And a couple different things we can do to help that is with everybody else together. So finding an exercise partner is always beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got one, don't you?
Yeah.
No, I'm looking at you because, yes, producer Jen and I are lifting partners. We lift together, but we are about to become your accountability people because you are going to come with us.
Well, yeah, I'll be there in February because it won't be so busy.
That is true. All right. What are some other ways that we can flip that and be part of the 20% instead of the 80%?
Well, finding something you really enjoy. So a lot of people say, well, I have to go to the gym again today. And reframing that, saying, well, not only do I get to go to the gym, I'm going to go do something enjoyable. So whether that's listening to an audiobook, plopping in front of Netflix, you know, while you're on the treadmill, finding something that you enjoy and doing it consistently is more important than, you know, getting on the treadmill and running for 5 miles. You know, it's not for everybody, but finding something you really enjoy is, I think, the most important piece when you do choose to go do some exercise.
When you outline a program for somebody, do you base it on how long they have to exercise, or do you say, you know what, we got to at least start with 20 minutes, or how do you decide how long what's enough?
Yeah, so the current recommendation right now is about 150 minutes of movement throughout the week. And so, again, 149 minutes, you're probably doing okay. But, you know, if you can only do 5 minutes a day or 10 minutes a day, that's still so much better than if you can't do any at all. And we know from research that people who are still struggling with the scale or obese and overweight, those people that exercise are actually much better off when it comes to their overall health and fitness than the people that are skinny and don't do any exercise. So every little bit does help.
If you've been someone who gets 0% of that 150 per week, maybe starting that high is not where you want to go.
Correct. So kind of slowly, you know, increasing it over time is wonderful. So maybe it comes back down to, I'm going to exercise for 1 minute today. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to jump on the treadmill for 1 minute. Probably when you're there, you're going to say, well, 1 minute was pretty easy. I can probably add a couple more. And that's my little sneaky way of, you know, increasing your overall exercise.
I kind of like that.
Yeah. There was for a long time about a 10% rule is you don't want to increase your overall kind of activity level greater than about 10%. But research has really shown that we don't necessarily need to adhere to that as much.
So what's the best tip that you have used to help people, something that you find that works for a lot of your clients?
I would say overall is finding what you like to do and then keep doing it. So we are lucky that we get to see people who are over 80, 90 years old, and you ask them, you know, you're still here, number one, which is wonderful, but number two, what's your secret for success? And it's really is, well, I don't go out and run a marathon every single day, but I do go out and walk for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And I do that most days of the week.
How often do you have someone come up to you and say, I can't thank you enough. I feel so much better and I've lost X amount of pounds. I bet that's fairly frequent, isn't it?
Very frequent, yes. And I want to toot my own horn, but yes, it is wonderful to hear those accolades that we get. And that's what really kind of propels us in the fitness industry to kind of keep going, is those kind of constant success stories that we do here.
All right, well, keep up the good work, and we'll see you at the dock.
Uh-huh.
We've been talking about ways to get moving and to be healthier in the new year with Tom Rick of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Living Program. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our program this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.